Welcome to our deep dive into Tanzania, a country that boasts a history spanning millions of years. We'll be using excerpts from the United Republic of Tanzania to explore how this nation earned its nickname as the cradle of mankind. And get this, we're talking about evidence dating back millions of years. Ready to have your mind blown?
Oh, absolutely. Tanzania is like a living museum of human evolution. I find it fascinating how it bridges our ancient past with the vibrant, complex country it is today.
Let's start our journey in Olduvai Gorge. It's this incredible archaeological site that has unearthed some of the most significant discoveries about our earliest ancestors. I mean, we're talking Paranthropus bones over 2 million years old. What's even more amazing are the Laetoli footprints discovered in the same area.
The Laetoli footprints are incredible. They're the oldest known footprints of human ancestors, clocking in at a mind-boggling 3.6 million years old. They actually predate the Paranthropus bones found in the gorge.
Whoa, I didn't realize they were even older. It's hard to even wrap your head around that kind of time scale. These footprints are concrete proof, literally, that our ancestors were walking this earth millions of years ago. Do you think early humans even remotely resembled us?
Well, Paranthropus were more like distant cousins than direct ancestors. They walked upright like us, but had much smaller brains and more robust features. They were probably using tools and potentially even communicating in ways we can't even imagine.
Okay, that's seriously cool. But we have these early hominids roaming around millions of years ago. What about, say, 10,000 years ago? Who was calling Tanzania home then?
Around that time, Tanzania was largely populated by hunter-gatherer communities, specifically the Khoisan people. Their languages were characterized by unique click sounds. The Khoisan were the original inhabitants of the region, and their way of life was deeply connected to the land and its resources.
So they lived off the land following animal migrations and gathering what they could. Makes you wonder what their lives were like. Then things start changing around 5,000 years ago with the arrival of new groups, right?
Groups speaking Cushitic languages, which originated further north in the Horn of Africa, started migrating into Tanzania, introducing agriculture and cattle herding to the region. This is a huge shift for the existing Khoisan communities.
I bet agriculture completely changes the game. You go from constantly moving around to having more settled communities. Did this lead to conflict between the Khoisan and the newcomers?
There was likely some tension, sure, but the evidence suggests that integration happened over time. The Khoisan adopted some of the agricultural practices, and the Cushitic speakers incorporated elements of the existing hunter-gatherer lifestyle.
So this melting pot of cultures was already bubbling away thousands of years ago. And then another wave hits about 2,000 years ago with the arrival of the Bantu people, right?
That's right. The Bantu migrations were a major event in African history. They originated in West Africa and spread across much of the continent, bringing with them iron working technologies and more complex systems of social and political organization. Their arrival further enriched the cultural landscape of Tanzania.
It's interesting how you mentioned more complex systems. What exactly does that mean? How are they different from the existing systems?
Well, the Bantu introduced more hierarchical social structures, including chiefdoms and kingdoms. They were skilled farmers and developed sophisticated methods of land management and crop cultivation. Their arrival definitely shook things up a bit.
I can imagine suddenly you have these new technologies and ways of living. Did the Bantu have a similar experience of integrating with the existing communities?
It seems that cultural exchange and integration continued. The Bantu languages, for example, spread throughout the region, often incorporating words and grammatical structures from the existing Cushitic and Khoisan languages.
So it was this constant back and forth, this blending of cultures. Fascinating how these early interactions laid the foundation for the diverse Tanzania we know today. But there's one more group we need to mention who arrived a bit later, right?
You're talking about the Nilotic pastoralists. They began migrating into the region from further north around the first millennium CE and continued arriving in waves even until the 18th century. They brought with them their own distinct cattle herding practices and cultural traditions.
CE, just to clarify for anyone who isn't familiar, CE stands for Common Era. It's basically the same as AD.
Sometimes you see BCE as well, which stands for Before Common Era and is the same as BC.
Thanks for clearing that up.
Sure.
So with the arrival of the Nilotic pastoralists, we have all these major cultural groups, the Khoisan, Cushitic, Bantu, and Nilotic people. all interacting and shaping the landscape of what we now know as Tanzania.
It's amazing to think how these migrations and interactions over millennia have shaped the cultural diversity of Tanzania.
It really is. And up until now, we've been focusing on inland Tanzania. But let's shift gears and head over to the coast.
Okay.
Where a completely different story is unfolding, one that leads to the rise of a powerful and influential civilization.
You're talking about the Swahili civilization, right? It's a story of vibrant trading cities, cultural fusion, and a unique language that became a cornerstone of East African identity.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'll find this especially interesting.
Okay, I'm ready to dive into the Swahili world. Before we get there, I'm curious, were there any connections between inland Tanzania and the coast during these early periods? Were they completely separate worlds?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Even in these early times, there were trade networks and cultural exchanges happening between the interior and the coastal regions.
Okay.
For example, ivory and other goods from the interior would have made their way to the coast, where they were traded with merchants from across the Indian Ocean.
Okay.
These connections would become even more significant as we move into the first millennium CE.
Interesting. So there's already this exchange happening, setting the stage for what's to come.
Right.
All right. Let's explore the emergence of this Swahili civilization. Where do we begin?
We need a picture of the East African coast around the first millennium CE.
Okay.
Arab, Persian, and Indian traders are sailing across the Indian Ocean, drawn by the allure of trade. They encounter vibrant Bantu communities along the coast. And
Hold on. I know we're jumping ahead.
Sorry.
Can we pause for a second and define exactly what we mean by Bantu? It's a term we've thrown around a lot, and I want to make sure we're all on the same page.
Of course, Bantu refers to a large group of people who speak languages belonging to the Bantu family.
Okay.
It's not a single ethnicity or tribe.
Right.
But rather a vast and diverse linguistic group that originated in West Africa and spread across much of the continent.
Okay.
Remember those migrations we talked about earlier?
Yeah.
Well, those were largely driven by Bantu-speaking communities.
Okay, that's super helpful. Now, I get why it's important to understand who the Bantu people were before we dive into the Swahili world. Thanks for clarifying that.
Sure.
Let's go back to those traders you were talking about.
Okay.
So they encounter these Bantu communities. Then what?
Well, these encounters were more than just fleeting trading interactions.
Yeah.
They sparked a period of intense cultural exchange and fusion.
Okay.
Over time, these coastal Bantu communities,
right,
influenced by their interactions with Arab, Persian, and Indian traders,
yeah,
began to develop their own distinct culture and language.
And that's how the Swahili civilization is born. It seems like more of a gradual evolution rather than a sudden event.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
It was an organic process driven by trade and cultural exchange rather than conquest. That's actually a common misconception. People often think that Swahili culture is primarily a product of Arab colonization.
Oh.
But our source makes it clear that's not the case.
Okay.
The development of Swahili civilization was uniquely African, shaped by a mix of internal and external influences.
Okay, so we're debunking myths right from the start.
Right.
I like it. Tell me more about this Swahili culture. What made it so unique?
Well, one of the most defining features of Swahili civilization was the development of the Kiswahili language.
Yeah.
It emerged as a lingua franca along the coast,
right,
blending Bantu roots with Arabic, Persian, and Indian influences. Imagine a bustling marketplace filled with the sounds of Kiswahili being spoken by merchants from different backgrounds, all coming together to trade and exchange ideas.
It sounds like a pretty cosmopolitan scene.
It was.
And Kiswahili wasn't just a language of trade, was it?
No, it evolved into much more than that. It became a language of literature, poetry, and even diplomacy. It helped to unify the diverse communities along the coast, fostering a sense of shared identity.
So we have this unique language that's developing. We have this bustling trade. What about the actual cities themselves? What were they like?
Think of thriving port cities like Kilwa, Mombasa, and Zanzibar.
Right.
They were strategically located along the coast, serving as hubs for trade routes that stretched across the Indian Ocean.
Let's zoom in on Kilwa for a moment.
Sure.
Our source mentions it was one of the earliest cities in the world to use money. What kind of money was it, and why was this so significant?
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Kilwa was using copper coins for trade as early as the 11th century. This early adoption of currency speaks volumes about their economic sophistication and how integrated they were into these vast trade networks.
Wow. Imagine that copper coins clinking in the marketplace.
Yeah.
It gives a real sense of what life was like back then. Our source also mentions a famous traveler named Ibn Battuta. What does he have to do with Kilwa?
Ibn Battuta was a Moroccan scholar and explorer who journeyed across the Islamic world in the 14th century.
Okay.
He visited Kilwa and was blown away by its grandeur and prosperity.
Really?
He described it as one of the most beautiful and well-constructed cities in the world.
Oh, wow.
His account offers a valuable glimpse into the splendor of Kilwa during his golden age.
That's pretty impressive. A seasoned traveler like Ibn Battuta, who had seen so much of the world, was utterly captivated by Kilwa. That really speaks to the magnificence of this Swahili civilization. Was this considered its golden age, or did it get even more impressive?
Well, the period between the 13th and 15th centuries is often referred to as the Shirazi era in Swahili history. It was a time of immense wealth and cultural flourishing for the Swahili city-states.
Wait, Shirazi era? What exactly does that mean? Was Shiraz involved somehow?
Great question. The term Shirazi is a bit misleading.
Oh.
It's based on a legend that claims the founders of Kilwa were Persian princes from Shiraz.
Oh.
However, modern scholarship suggests that the Shirazi era was more of a period of internal development and cultural synthesis within the Swahili world, rather than a result of direct Persian influence.
So it was less about Persian control and more about the Swahili people coming into their own.
Exactly. And they were certainly thriving.
Yeah.
During the Shirazi era, trade networks expanded, architecture flourished, and Swahili culture reached new heights of sophistication.
Wow.
Kilwa in particular became a major center for the trade of gold, ivory, and other precious goods. Think of elaborately carved wooden doors, intricate mosques, and bustling marketplaces filled with exotic goods from across the Indian Ocean.
It's like something out of Arabian Nights. I can practically smell the spices and hear the languages from all corners of the world blending together.
I can imagine.
It's amazing to think that this vibrant civilization was thriving in East Africa centuries ago. But unfortunately, as we know, this golden age couldn't last forever. Enter the Europeans.
Yes. The arrival of Vasco da Gama in 1498 marks a pivotal turning point in Swahili history.
Right.
It's the beginning of a new chapter one that would bring significant changes to the East African coast and the Swahili people.
And I have a feeling those changes aren't going to be all sunshine and roses.
Hmm.
This encounter with the Europeans is going to set the stage for a much more complex and tumultuous period in Tanzanian history, right?
Indeed. The arrival of the Europeans would disrupt the existing power dynamics, leading to a period of colonial influence and ultimately the loss of autonomy for the Swahili people.
Right.
But that's a story for our next chapter.
Okay. I'm both fascinated and a little apprehensive about where we're headed next. But for now, let's just take a moment to appreciate the incredible achievements of the Swahili civilization.
I agree.
Their unique language, their vibrant culture, and their impact on East African history. It's a story that deserves to be told and celebrated.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we left off with Vasco da Gama's arrival in 1498.
Right.
It's fascinating how this single event set in motion a chain of events that would reshape the entire East African coast.
It's almost like a ripple effect, right? Yeah. One ship arriving and suddenly everything starts to change.
Exactly.
Our source tells us that the Portuguese wasted no time in asserting their dominance.
Right.
Taking control of key Swahili city-states within a few decades.
Yeah.
What were they after? Was it purely about power or was there more to it?
Well, like most colonial endeavors, it was a mix of economic and political ambitions.
Okay.
The Portuguese were initially drawn to the lucrative spice trade.
Right.
They wanted to control the flow of goods coming from Asia and saw the Swahili city-states as key strategic points along these trade routes.
So they basically wanted to cut out the Swahili middleman and control the trade themselves. Did they succeed?
Yes and no.
Okay.
While the Portuguese did manage to establish a presence along the coast and disrupt existing trade networks,
right,
they never fully achieved the complete dominance they sought.
Okay.
They faced resistance from the Swahili people and competition from other European powers who were also eager to get a slice of the action.
Okay. So it's not a simple story of the Portuguese just rolling in and taking over.
No.
There was pushback and other players entered the scene. Who were these other contenders?
Well, as the Portuguese grip on the East African coast started to weaken,
okay,
you have the Omani Arabs stepping in.
Okay.
They were already a powerful force in the region and seized the opportunity to expand their influence.
Right.
By the 18th century, they had effectively wrestled control of the Swahili coast from the Portuguese.
Really?
Zanzibar in particular became a central hub for their operations.
That's interesting. I always associate Zanzibar with the spice trade,
yeah,
not necessarily with the Omani Arabs.
Uh-huh.
What was their main focus? Were they primarily interested in spices, or did they have other ambitions?
While the scouse trade was certainly a factor, the Omani Arabs had broader ambitions. They wanted to control the entire East African coast. And they saw Zanzibar as a strategically vital location for achieving that goal. They established plantations for cloves and other spices.
Right.
But they were also involved in the ivory trade and, sadly, the slave trade.
That's a dark chapter indeed. The slave trade is a horrific reminder of the human costs of colonialism and greed.
It is.
So, while the Omani Arabs are consolidating their control, what's happening with the other European powers, you mentioned they were vying for influence too, right?
You're right. It's like a geopolitical chess match playing out across the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
While the Portuguese and the Omani Arabs were the main players early on.
Right.
You also had the Dutch, English, and French all making their moves.
Oh, okay.
They were establishing trading posts, forging alliances, and generally trying to carve out their own spheres of influence in the region.
I'm imagining a lot of backstabbing and double dealing going on.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like, everyone is trying to outmaneuver everyone else. In the end, who comes out on top in this power struggle?
Well, as you might have guessed, it's the British.
Yeah.
Through a combination of shrewd diplomacy,
right,
military might, and economic leverage, they managed to outmaneuver their rivals and establish themselves as the dominant force in East Africa by the 19th century.
I guess it's not surprising considering their track record elsewhere in the world. But before we delve into British rule, I want to touch on something that always fascinates me.
Okay.
The European explorers who ventured into the interior of Tanzania during this period,
yeah,
our source mentions a few names. Wedman Burton speak Livingstone.
Yeah.
These guys were like the Indiana Joneses of their time, weren't they?
They were. Their stories are filled with adventure, danger, and a thirst for discovery.
Right.
It's important to acknowledge that their explorations were often intertwined with colonial ambitions.
Right.
But they also contributed significantly to our understanding of the geography, cultures, and natural wonders of Tanzania.
Okay, let's unpack a few of these expeditions.
Yeah.
First, we have Johannes Rebman. Our source says he was the first European to lay eyes on Mount Kilimanjaro. What year was this, and what must it have been like to see that majestic peak for the first time?
It was in 1848.
Wow.
And you can only imagine the awe Rebman must have felt. Imagine trekking through the African savanna, and suddenly this colossal snow-capped mountain emerges on the horizon.
Hmm?
It would have been an absolutely breathtaking sight.
Right.
His discovery caused quite a stir in Europe, as many people initially doubted his claims of seeing snow so close to the equator.
It's incredible to think about the impact these discoveries had on the European imagination.
Yeah.
They really fueled the sense of wonder and mystery about Africa.
Yeah.
What about Burton and Speke? What were they known for?
Richard Burton and John Hanning Speke were another dynamic duo of exploration. They set out from Zanzibar in 1857 with the goal of finding the source of the Nile.
Wow.
A mystery that had captivated Europeans for centuries. In 1858, they became the first Europeans to reach Lake Tanganyika, one of the largest freshwater lakes in the world. Their expedition was fraught with challenges, disease-hostile tribes, and even a falling out between the two explorers.
Oh, wow. Sounds like there was some drama on that expedition.
There was.
And then there's the legendary Dr. Livingstone. I mean, his name is practically synonymous with African exploration. What was his story?
David Livingstone was a Scottish missionary and explorer who was deeply committed to exploring the interior of Africa.
Okay.
And opening it up to European influence, but primarily for missionary work and to combat the slave trade.
Oh.
He spent years traveling through the region, mapping rivers, documenting wildlife, and engaging with local communities.
Okay.
He disappeared into the African interior in 1866, prompting a frantic search for him.
And that's where Henry Morton Stanley comes in, right? With the famous line, Dr. Livingstone, I presume.
Exactly. Stanley, an American journalist, was sent by the New York Herald to find Livingstone.
Wow.
He tracked him down on the shores of Lake Tanganyika in 1871, uttering those now iconic words.
Wow.
Their encounter became a global sensation, further fueling European fascination with Africa.
It's amazing how these individual stories of exploration captured the imagination of the world. But as you mentioned earlier, these expeditions were often intertwined with colonial ambitions.
They were.
While these explorers were making these incredible discoveries, the stage was being set for a much larger power grab, right?
That's right. By the late 19th century, the so-called scramble for Africa was in full swing.
Okay.
European powers, driven by economic and political competition,
yeah,
were rushing to claim territories across the continent.
Right.
And Tanzania, like much of Africa, was caught in the middle of this geopolitical power play.
It's almost as if the explorations we just talked about were a prelude to this larger scramble.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were scouting out the land and paving the way for colonization.
there's definitely a connection there. The information gathered by these explorers, the maps they drew, the relationships they formed, all of this contributed to the European understanding of Africa and ultimately facilitated their colonization efforts.
So how does the scramble actually play out in Tanzania? I mean, we know European powers are vying for control, but how are they actually dividing up the land?
This is where the infamous Berlin Conference of 1885 comes in. It was a gathering of European powers with no African representation.
Oh, wow.
Who met to formalize their claims to various parts of Africa. Essentially, they were dividing up the continent amongst themselves.
Wow.
Drawing lines on a map with little regard for the existing ethnic and cultural boundaries.
It's a striking example of how colonialism operated.
Right.
Completely disregarding the people who actually lived there.
It was a terrible injustice.
So what does this mean for Tanzania? What happens to this land that had been home to so many different cultures for thousands of years?
Well, as a result of the Berlin Conference, Tanganyika,
right,
which is what mainland Tanzania was called at that time,
okay,
ends up under German control. It's interesting because initially the Belgians had a presence in the region.
Mm.
They even established stations on Lake Tanganyika.
Oh, really?
But their focus soon shifted to the Congo, leaving the Germans to solidify their hold on Tanganyika.
Okay, so now we have a new player in the mix, the Germans. How does their presence in Tanganyika differ from what we've seen with the Portuguese and the Omani Arabs?
The Germans took a more systematic approach to colonization.
Ah.
They focused on developing infrastructure, establishing plantations for cash crops like sisal and coffee, and extracting resources.
Right.
They also imposed their own systems of administration and education, trying to reshape Tanganyika according to their vision.
It sounds like they were trying to create a mini Germany in East Africa. How did the local population respond to this?
There was resistance, of course.
Mm-hmm.
People resented being ruled by a foreign power and being forced to conform to alien ways of life. However, the Germans had a powerful military and were able to quell any major uprisings.
So Tanganyika is under German control, but as we know, history is full of twists and turns. What happens next in this saga?
Well, the German reign in Tanganyika would be relatively short-lived. With the outbreak of World War I in 1914, the focus shifts to the battlefields of Europe.
Right.
The British, allied with the Belgians, launch an offensive against German East Africa.
Okay.
And by 1918, they've taken control of the territory.
So Tanganyika goes from German control to British control.
That's right.
It's amazing how these major world events are playing out on this stage in East Africa. What happens to Tanganyika after the war? Does it become part of the British Empire?
Not exactly. After World War I, the League of Nations, which was like the precursor to the United Nations, was formed with the aim of preventing future wars and promoting international cooperation. They established a system of mandates where former German and Ottoman territories were entrusted to other nations to administer until they could supposedly govern themselves.
Right.
Tanganyika became a British mandate.
So it's still under British control, but technically not a colony.
Hmm.
What does this change in terms of how Tanganyika is governed?
Well, the mandate system was supposed to promote the development and well-being of the mandated territories. In reality, it often functioned as a thinly veiled form of colonialism. The British continued to exploit Tanganyika's resources and exert significant control over its political and economic affairs.
So it's a change in name, but not necessarily a change in practice.
Mm.
And I'm guessing this sets the stage for the independence movement that will eventually sweep across Africa.
You're exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
The seeds of independence were being sown during this period.
Yeah.
Tanganyikans, like people across Africa, were increasingly demanding self-determination and an end to colonial rule.
Right.
The experience of World War II, where many Africans fought alongside European powers, further fueled these aspirations for freedom.
Right.
And it's during this time that a very important figure emerges on the scene. Julius Nyer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nyer, the father of Tanzanian independence.
That's right.
Before we dive into his story, can you give us a little background on the overall context of independence movements in Africa? What factors were driving this widespread push for self-determination?
It was a confluence of factors. World War II had weakened European powers and made it harder for them to maintain their colonial empires. The rise of nationalist movements across the globe, the growing influence of pan-Africanist ideologies, and the inspiration of successful independence struggles in other parts of the world, like India.
Yeah.
All of these contributed to the momentum for change in Africa.
It's like everything was aligning to create this perfect storm for independence. Okay, let's bring Julius Nyer back into the spotlight. Who was he, and what role did he play in Tanganyika's journey towards independence?
Nyer was a visionary leader, a teacher by profession,
right,
who emerged as a key figure in the Tanganyikan African National Union, or TANNU.
Okay.
He was a brilliant orator and a staunch advocate for independence. He dabbled extensively, mobilizing support for the cause.
Right.
And he skillfully negotiated with the British for a peaceful transition to self-rule.
So he was a combination of charisma, political savvy, and unwavering dedication to his people. It sounds like he was the perfect person to lead Tanganyika through this pivotal moment in history.
Absolutely. Nyer's leadership was instrumental in securing Tanganyika's independence in 1961.
Okay.
He became the country's first prime minister.
Okay.
Guiding it through the early years of nation building.
Right.
But the story doesn't end there. Just 3 years later, in 1964, a momentous event occurs.
Okay.
The unification of Tanganyika and Zanzibar.
Whoa, hold on. I know we're about to enter a whole new chapter in Tanzanian history, but before we get there, I'm curious about something. We've talked a lot about Tanganyika, but we haven't really touched on Zanzibar's story during this period.
Okay.
What was happening on the island while all of this was unfolding on the mainland?
That's a great question. Zanzibar had its own unique trajectory. While it was initially under Omani Arab control, it became a British protectorate in 1890.
Okay.
It had a very different social and political structure compared to Tanganyika, with a strong Arab influence and a history of its own sultanate.
So these two entities, Tanganyika and Zanzibar,
yeah,
they're coming from very different backgrounds with different histories, different cultures. How do they end up uniting? What's the story behind this unification?
It's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
Zanzibar had also gained its independence from Britain in 1963. However, shortly after independence, there was a revolution on the island, which led to the overthrow of the Arab-dominated government.
A revolution. That sounds intense. What were the driving forces behind this revolution?
Well, there was growing discontent among the African population who felt marginalized and excluded from power. They resented the dominance of the Arab elite and demanded a more equitable society. The revolution was swift and violent, leading to a significant shift in power dynamics on the island.
So Zanzibar undergoes this revolution, and at the same time, Tanganyika is navigating its own newfound independence.
Yeah.
How did these two events converge to create the United Republic of Tanzania?
It's a combination of factors. Nyer, with his vision of a united and prosperous East Africa, saw the potential for a union between Tanganyika and Zanzibar. He believed that by joining forces, they could overcome the legacy of colonialism and build a stronger nation.
It's a bold move, considering the different histories and power structures of these two entities. Was there support for this union on both sides?
It was a complex situation. There were certainly those who had reservations both in Tanganyika and Zanzibar. Some worried about the potential for dominance from one side or the other. Others questioned whether such different societies could truly integrate. But ultimately, the desire for unity and the belief that a shared future outweighed the differences prevailed.
So in 1964, the United Republic of Tanzania is born.
Yes.
It's a remarkable achievement, uniting these two distinct entities into a single nation. What happens next? How does this new nation begin to forge its own identity and navigate the challenges of independence?
Well, that's where the story gets even more interesting. The unification of Tanganyika and Zanzibar is just the beginning.
Right.
The newly formed Tanzania faces the task of building a unified nation, overcoming the legacy of colonialism, and navigating the complexities of the Cold War world. And at the helm of this new nation is Julius Nyer, a leader with a unique vision for a socialist, self-reliant Tanzania.
Okay, I'm definitely sensing a to-be-continued five-tier. We've covered so much ground already, from ancient human ancestors to European explorers, colonial power struggles, and the birth of a new nation.
We have.
It's mind-blowing to think how all of these threads are woven together to create the tapestry of Tanzanian history.
It's amazing, isn't it, to see how all these seemingly disparate events and influences have converged to create the Tanzania we know today. And we're not done yet. There's still so much to explore about how this new nation found its footing on the world stage.
We've journeyed through millions of years of history, tracing Tanzania's path from the cradle of mankind to a unified nation grappling with the complexities of independence. I have to say, this deep dive has been an incredible ride so far.
It is amazing, isn't it, to see how all these seemingly disparate events and influences have converged to create the Tanzania we know today, and we're not done yet. There's still so much to explore about how this new nation found its footing on the world stage.
You mentioned Julius Nyer had a unique vision for Tanzania. Can you elaborate on that? What were his goals for this newly independent nation?
Nyer was a passionate advocate for African socialism, mm-hmm, which he termed Ujamaa. a Swahili word emphasizing community and cooperation.
Right.
He believed that Tanzania could achieve true independence and prosperity by building a society based on equality, self-reliance, and communal living. It was a bold vision.
Right.
One that aimed to break away from the colonial economic model and forge a new path for development.
So instead of relying on outside powers, he wanted Tanzania to be self-sufficient. What were some of the concrete steps he took to implement this vision?
One of Nair's most ambitious initiatives was the Ujamaa Village Program, launched in 1967.
Okay.
He encouraged people to move from scattered rural homesteads into collectivized villages where they could work together, share resources, and build a more equitable society.
Okay.
He believed this would lead to increased agricultural productivity, improved social services, and a stronger sense of national unity.
It sounds like a radical experiment, almost utopian in a way. Was it successful? Did it achieve what Nair had hoped for?
Well, the results were mixed.
Okay.
While there were some successes in terms of improving literacy rates and access to healthcare.
Right.
The Ujamaa program also faced significant challenges.
Okay.
Many people were reluctant to abandon their traditional ways of life.
Right.
And forced relocation led to resentment and resistance. Agricultural production didn't always increase as expected.
Mm-hmm.
And the program struggled to achieve economic self-sufficiency.
It's a reminder that even the best intentions can have unintended consequences. So what happened to the Ujamaa program? Did it continue throughout Nair's presidency?
Nair remained committed to the principles of Ujamaa throughout his time in office. But he also made adjustments to the program in response to the challenges it faced. By the 1970s, the focus shifted from large-scale collectivization to smaller, more voluntary village cooperatives.
Right.
The emphasis on self-reliance remained. But there was a greater recognition of the need for individual initiative and economic diversification.
It's interesting to see how Nair adapted his approach while still holding on to his core values. What were some of the other key aspects of his leadership? How did he shape Tanzania's domestic and foreign policies?
Nair was a strong advocate for education and literacy.
Okay.
He believed that an educated population was essential for national development and social progress.
Okay.
He invested heavily in expanding educational opportunities, particularly in rural areas. He also promoted Swahili as a national language.
Oh, that's interesting.
Helping to foster a sense of shared identity among Tanzania's diverse population.
That's a smart move. Having a common language can really help to bridge cultural divides.
Yeah.
What about his foreign policy? What was Tanzania's position on the world stage during this turbulent period of the Cold War?
Nair adopted a policy of non-alignment, refusing to take sides in the ideological battle between the United States and the Soviet Union. He believed that Tanzania should chart its own course, pursuing policies that served its own national interests.
Okay.
He was a vocal critic of colonialism and apartheid in South Africa.
Right.
And he actively supported liberation movements across the continent.
So he was a champion for African independence and self-determination. It sounds like he played a significant role in shaping the Pan-African movement.
Absolutely. Tanzania, under Nair, became a haven for refugees and freedom fighters from across southern Africa.
Wow.
He provided material and logistical support to liberation movements in Mozambique, Angola, Zimbabwe, and South Africa.
Okay.
Helping to accelerate the dismantling of colonial rule and apartheid.
It's inspiring to see how a relatively small nation like Tanzania could have such a significant impact on the international stage.
It is.
Nair's leadership clearly resonated with people far beyond Tanzania's borders.
He was admired globally.
So we've talked a lot about Nair's vision, his achievements, and the challenges he faced. But what about the everyday lives of Tanzanians during this period? How did independence and Nair's policies impact their experiences?
Well, independence brought about significant changes for ordinary Tanzanians.
Okay.
Access to education and healthcare improved, particularly in rural areas. The emphasis on self-reliance led to the development of local industries and cooperatives. Swahili gained prominence as a national language, further uniting the diverse population. However, there were also challenges. Economic progress was slow, and many people continued to live in poverty. The Ujamaa program, while well-intentioned, disrupted traditional ways of life and didn't always deliver the promised benefits.
It sounds like a period of both progress and struggle.
It was.
A time of great hope and also some disillusionment. I'm curious about the transition of power after Nair stepped down in 1985.
Right.
Was it a smooth handover or was there a period of instability?
Nair's decision to voluntarily step down was a rare occurrence in post-colonial Africa,
wow,
where leaders often clung to power. His successor, Ali Hassan Mwinyi, continued many of Nair's policies, but he also introduced some economic reforms, moving away from the socialist model towards a more market-oriented approach.
So a bit of a shift in direction, but a peaceful transition nonetheless. That's pretty remarkable considering the political turmoil that plagued many other African nations during this period.
It is. It speaks to the stability that Nyer helped to establish in Tanzania.
Right.
He left behind a legacy of peace, unity, and a strong sense of national identity.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground here, from ancient origins to independence, from Nyer's socialist vision to the challenges and triumphs of nation building. As we wrap up this deep dive, I'm left with a sense of awe at the resilience and adaptability of the Tanzanian people. They've navigated incredible changes and upheavals throughout their history, yet they've emerged as a nation with a strong sense of identity and a commitment to peace and unity.
What's fascinating to me is how Tanzania's story exemplifies the broader themes of African history. The struggle against colonialism, the quest for self-determination, the challenges of development, and the search for a model that balances tradition with modernity.
Right.
It's a story that continues to unfold with new challenges and opportunities emerging in the 21st century.
That's a great point. We've only scratched the surface of Tanzania's journey. There's so much more to explore, so much more to learn from this remarkable nation. And as we conclude, I'm left wondering what the future holds for Tanzania. How will it navigate the complexities of globalization, climate change, and the ever-evolving political landscape? What role will it play on the regional and international stage? These are questions that only time will answer.
And those questions are exactly what make history so captivating. It's not just about the past.
Yeah.
It's about understanding the forces that have shaped our present and anticipating the possibilities of the future. Tanzania's story, with its rich tapestry of human experience, offers valuable insights and inspiration for us all as we grapple with the challenges and opportunities of our own time.
Beautifully said. I hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity about Tanzania and its captivating history. I encourage you to continue exploring, to delve deeper into this incredible nation and its people. Who knows, maybe someday we'll revisit the story and uncover even more layers of its complexity. Thanks for joining us on this incredible journey.